At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
Hello and welcome to episode 111 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's ongoing quest to find a definitive answer to the question, what is it about this game that gets under the skin of so many otherwise intelligent people? My name's Rod Morrie, and if you followed golf in Europe or Australia in the 80s and 90s, you'll be familiar with the name Ronan Rafferty. The Northern Irishman was one of the era's most popular players, and as a regular visitor to Australia, he was as much a fan favourite here as anywhere in the world. Rafferty won five times in this part of the world, and counts his victories in the Australian match play at Kingston Heath and the Coca-Cola Classic at Royal Melbourne as among his proudest achievements. He also says coming to Australia was crucial in taking his game to the next level. Recently, Rafferty sat down with John Huggan to look back on a lifetime in the game, from child prodigy to touring pro in the glory days of the European Tour. It's a brilliant discussion full of great stories of a bygone era and thoughtful analysis of how and why the game has changed so much.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time around is someone I've known a long time, actually, to the point where I was going to say that we competed against each other, but we didn't really compete in that I had absolutely no chance of winning. But anyway, welcome, Ronan Rafferty. What was and is the thing about golf for you?
Go straight into the deep end, John. Bloody hell. Golf for me. I would have said that golf for me has been different things over different eras. When I was a kid growing up in Northern Ireland, golf was a sort of sanctuary. Getting away from what was going on in Northern Ireland. I mean, I was very lucky. I went to a great school that had a golf team and that we were introduced to golf. I mean, this is, you know, middle, late 70s, so golf wasn't exactly a popular game.
Even in Northern Ireland?
Well, it wasn't the thing to do. You know, football, Gaelic football, right. Hockey, hurling, you know, was still a big thing. So golf wasn't a sport that you suddenly, well, certainly not that boys, yeah, kids went and did. So golf for me was something, first of all, I was good at it. For some reason, I had coordination at it and I was keen to do it. Plus, I was keen to do the work, which is probably more to do with the fact that I didn't want to go to school. Yeah. But also I went to a golf club, One Point Golf Club, where I did sort of start my career on, that the pro Don Patterson, who taught me and was sort of a pro in my early middle career. He was the pro at the golf club, and there were three youth internationals in the 1 year, and one of the first times I got taken down to the golf club, they were all practicing and they all had the green blazers on, and they were going to play golf in England.
Ooh.
And England was a million miles away, a thing. But it was the fact that these guys were playing, and that's what, you know, I got a straight away. That's what I was striving for. So I wanted to put the work in. I was keen. I got good pretty early. So in those days, golf was me getting away from school, was getting away from life in Northern Ireland. Plus, I was good at it. So it was a sort of, for me, golf, going to a golf course was like a safe haven. Then, of course, you progress through the thing. You start playing for your club, country, province, country, GB&I, and you're traveling more. You go into events. You've been sent around the world. I got picked on the Eisenhower team when I was 16.
Now you're skipping right on through this. I want to spend a bit more time
thinking. I got quite good quite early, so I played for Ireland as a boy international at 14 at the British Boys at Seton Carew in 1978. But by 15, I was playing for GB&I boys, youth, and seniors. So something had to sort of drop out of it. But this sort of era was me preparing, you know, from when I got half decent, which was around about 12, 13, 14, I wanted to be a pro. So my next bundle of years were being basically preparation to be a professional. And then I went off to my professional career. And then that was what I wanted to do. So it was sanctuary to start with. It was something was good. Then became my career, became how I earned money. And then you win tournaments and you go out the other end, you know, playing the Ryder Cup, as you know, and still won tournaments around the world. I mean, won South America, won New Zealand, won Australia, and then you sort of, well, kids come along and you know, your career dwindles a little bit, so it becomes a different thing. Then I got injured and then went off to do TV. So for me, golf, what the thing about golf was, it has different eras of what...
It's always been the thread, hasn't
but
it?
It's always been the thread. It's always been the background. I'll always do it until the day I can. And even then, when I probably can't, I'll still be doing something in golf. But I've always done golf, but it's always been in the background. But I say different sort of eras. I say it was Sanctuary, was my career, was the sort of aftermath, was because of my career, I was able to go on and do television, radio, whatever it was. And then, you know, more recently, the last sort of 10, 15 years into the sort of corporate stuff, and now I'm the ambassador for Renaissance. So it's been in stages, but always in the background, golf has been my sanctuary.
That might be the most comprehensive answer we've ever had to that question, by the way. But anyway... You skipped on by this, you know, I was good quite early, or I was quite good early. Now, you're understating there. Come on.
Well,
I can remember when you appeared, and you were a complete prodigy at that point. I mean, you were incredibly good at about 15.
Oh, I was good before that.
Well, yes, but incredibly good at 15.
Well, I was playing for GB and I when I was 15, Boys Youth and Senior. So, but, you know, it was the thing where I had lots of people in the background. Say, my parents had to take me go. My club, my school, the pro at the golf club, everyone was there encouraging me to go and do what I wanted to do. And this was in an era where you could, should we say, skip the odd day out of school. Yeah. And so because I was doing well, the school were quite, should we say, lenient.
Yeah. Well, when did the light go on, though? When did you twig that you were exceptional at this?
I'm going to say really early, when I was 12. I played by accident. I ended up playing in a pro-am. That somebody had pulled out, and that my dad had played earlier. He was the captain of the golf club. He'd been invited to play in this pro-am. Somebody had pulled out in the afternoon. They needed somebody. My dad sort of went, he'll play. And I had to use my dad's clubs. Anyway, didn't shoot 76 when I was 12 off the sort of men's tees and win the thing. So I think that was about the first time there was an inkling of I can sort of do this. But in the background, I would say that's what I was practicing for. And even in those days where people... You know, today they go out and hit balls for 2 hours and think that they've done a day's work. Well, we used to play 54 holes a day and then hit balls in between and chip and putt afterwards. You know, as soon as it was bright, you were doing it and you were still doing it when it was dark. And so that's why I was able to progress quite quickly. There was a bunch of really good kids. We all played together and we were all trying to beat each other.
Yeah, that's what you needed.
Yeah, you need competitive play. Yeah. Hitting balls on a range ain't going to do it for you. You need to have a scorecard.
Yeah, it was interesting, something you kind of touched on. You were basically, you knew really early on that you were going to be a pro. And you said something like you were basically using your amateur career to prepare to be a pro. Yeah. Now, most people, like me being a good example, I was just happy to be part of the, you know, that was as far as I was ever going to go. That was my level. But, and I was thinking, playing for Scotland and all the rest of it was great fun. And that was... But that was it.
That was a stepping.
You were just using.
No, that was
it.
A stepping stone.
You were just using us way past.
Well, the Boys Youth and Senior stuff was a stepping stone to progress with the career. I mean, I started playing. People forget, you know, the big ball and the small ball was still being played, say, in the Open Championship.
74 was the first Open.
Well, right thing. So, you know, 76, I had already started playing. I was 9 when I first started. So by 12, by 78, I knew what I was going to do. You know, I was playing the big ball with a 12-year-old. And so by 14, I was already causing consternation because, you know, amateur golf and interprovincial golf and country golf, you know, there's foursomes and you've got a partner. And so lucky enough that Philip Walton and I were Irish partners as a boy, youth and senior, and he wanted to be a pro as well. So we had no problem playing the big ball, but going on to some other stuff, there was always a problem along the line somewhere I wanted to play a big ball and somebody wanted to play a small
ball. You should mention that. I remember I was on the 1981 European Team Championship at St Andrews. Mm. I was part of that, the Scottish team. And I remember you being there, and I remember us saying from a distance, there was a bit of a controversy with you and Arthur Pierce.
Yeah.
who was going to play the small ball.
But there wasn't really a controversy. It was just the sort of circumstances that happened at the time where, you know, we were, you know, as you, because you, people forget you could change your golf ball in those days. And so we elected to sort of, you know, downwind play a big ball and into the wind play a small ball. And it just happened that this par five was actually downwind, but we could knock it onto. Anyway, a small ball was hit off the tee and it was now my shot, the next one. And after playing the sort of big ball thing, this thing looked like a marble. Yeah. And anyway, and that's what sort of happened. But I wasn't happy at the time because...
Would it be fair to say you and Joe Carr didn't quite see eye to eye?
No, that wouldn't be true at all, John.
Joe, well, that was what we were hearing.
No, Joe, yeah. Joe was... I have nothing but utmost admiration for Joe and anything he did, because he always did it for the right reason. And there is a thing about it as well, is that in those days when it was okay to give somebody a clip around the ear and tell them that they were doing it wrong and try better, Joe, well, he wouldn't have done that with me, but he certainly would have gone and told me what I either should have done or could have done, whatever it is, but also talk to me as a person, not as a father and son. And so Joe would always say, he'd come up and wag his finger and it looked like he was giving you a telling off, but actually he was going, keep going, lad, and doing what you're doing, you know, because I think he saw the fact that I was one of the few that probably worked as hard, if not harder, than he did in his career, because it doesn't happen. And there are some great stories about Joe wearing out the faces of nine irons and wedges and putters and breaking drivers and stuff because he practiced so much. Right. And because he, you know, you forget he won every championship under the sun, played in the Masters several times, was big pals with Jack and Arnie and whatever. So, and he was playing a lot of pro tournaments. He probably played nearly more pro tournaments at one stage than he did amateur events. So he probably saw the fact that I was different to the rest of them. So as I say, he was wagging one finger and actually saying, well done, boy, off.
Right, okay, right. Well, before we skip on by the amateur career that you skipped on by a minute ago, what were the highlights? What do you look back on most fondly?
You know, I think there's things, again, I talk about the whole progression of stuff, because I think you've got to experience things to move on. One of the best things I ever did was pre-qualify for the Irish Open. I went to the Monday qualifying. Those days, if you were sort of scratch or better, you could play the Monday qualifying. And there was only five or six spots, and I played in the Monday qualifying for the Irish Open at Royal Dublin and led the qualifiers. You know, and so as a 14-year-old, I'm pegging it up. As a 15-year-old, I then play in it because it was part of the Irish team. As a 16-year-old, I play in the game because I won the Irish championship, and the champion gets in. But at 16 as well, I qualified for the Open at St Andrews. At Muirfield at Loughness as a 16-year-old. So these are highlights in my career. Now, I was winning stuff. So winning at Royal County Down was a huge thing at 16, winning the Irish Championship. But also playing in the Open at Muirfield, playing the three Irish Opens by the time I was 16.
Which Open at Muirfield was that, 87?
80.
80?
80, yeah, as a 16-year-old. Wow. Yeah. I can ask you a Trivial Pursuit question that, but it would take you too long.
I caddied in that Open, so...
So as a 16-year-old amateur playing in the Open at Muirfield... In 1980, I was the second youngest amateur to have ever played in the Open at the time. Who was the first?
Youngest amateur?
Who was the first?
Oh, I wouldn't have a clue.
Tom Morris Jr.
Well, there you go. Was he still amateur?
Yeah, he was an amateur, 15-year-old amateur.
See, I thought of him, but then I thought, well, he was a pro.
No, he was an amateur. You know, these are highlights and these are things you want to do. But, you know, I got picked in the Eisenhower at Pinehurst as well, playing, you know, four-man stroke play team for your country. So I actually did that before the Walker Cup, because normally people do it the other way around. And I was on the team, you know, with the, you know, at the time, the sort of greatest British amateur, Peter McAvoy, Gordon Brown Jr., Ian Hutchin. You know, these were a team. You know, these were stalwart players, Jr., who wanted to be a pro as well. So we had a lot of things in common. And at this time as well, I'd basically gone to the UK to play tournaments. The Irish team, the Irish Union sent us over to the Lytham Trophy, which used to be in April. And I basically never went home. So basically in 79, I went to the Lytham Trophy and never went home. Yeah, literally. So I was playing in the UK, was playing the stuff. Never won the British Amateur, would have liked to have done that. But I was doing and playing and things, and progressing my career with the whole goal to turn pro and doing everything I could to be a professional.
Yeah. the former guest on this this podcast, Peter McAvoy, who we both know well, you were he mentioned you because he went a very long time
not losing any matches.
And now I've got a part of this story as well, because my claim to fame is that I was the last person he beat while he was unbeaten. And you beat him the next day.
I did, yeah.
Woodhall Spa.
Woodhall Spa, yeah. And I was turning pro 2 days later.
Right, yeah.
I was one of the few people who knew that. Yeah, I got in on that. And I was going home. I don't know when it was. I think it was on a Friday. I was playing in something in Ireland over the weekend and was turning pro on the Monday. So it was a sort of good way to go out. But that's what you were there for. You know, I didn't think about it as a goal. It was just something you did because, A, you were playing for your country, you were trying to succeed, you were trying to get better, and he, at the time, was one of the, you know, country's best amateurs.
Well, he would have been a good pro.
Was a goal. You know, everything was a goal. You know, set yourself. I wouldn't say it was ever targets. I never liked the thing of something, oh, I've got a whole, you know, load of targets for this year. But you certainly need to set yourself ambitions to progress. And if you're not progressing, then you need to have a look at it again and start again. And the one thing that back in those days, I was never afraid to work.
You would see guys like this, because I certainly did. I didn't go any further than playing for Scotland because that was as good as I was. But I saw plenty of guys who their ambition was to make the team. It wasn't to win once they got there. It was
this is going to sound really terrible. I mean, most of the teams are 10, 12 players. You know, somebody posted a picture a few years ago of the, you know, the 8 or 10 man Irish team that went to the boys' championship in, you know, Barcelona with a, you know, I know him, I know him, I know him, I know him. It was a bit like, don't know who that is. Don't know who that is. Don't know who that is. And that's, you know, that's terrible because, you know, I even on the team, you felt as though you were better than the rest of the players. And that's where I wanted to be. You know, I wanted to lead the team, play number one, be the first, you know, foursomes out in the morning, leading and doing stuff like that, because that's where I felt I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And well, in a way, you're hoping to drag the people with, you know, it is, you know, because that's what you did when you were at your home golf club. We had to say a pool of juniors who played all together. You were never going, oh, I'm better than you, I'm not going with you. You're going, I've now got better than you. You need to put this work in to get up to me, you know, and go on. And so everyone was egging each other on to be a better player. And I always wanted to do that with the rest of my team was, you know, if I can do this, you can do this. It just takes a bit of work and a bit of gumption and a bit of confidence. You know, there's you know, people say to you,
well, it's you never like that, Ronan.
Well, I had my moments about it, but you know, there's a whole thing about golf is that you need to have a bit of confidence about what you're doing.
Yeah. Before we skip on by again the team stuff, I wanted to talk to you a wee bit about the Walker Cup that you played in, and then we'll go straight into the Ryder Cup.
Compare
80, and contrast.
Well, 81 Cypress Point was a real thrill. I mean, there was we felt as though we had a pretty good team. There was a few youngsters on it: Paul Way, Roger Chapman, Colin Dalglish, myself. But then we were up against a formidable bunch of Americans. It was right at the era where amateurs were turning pro younger. They were doing well in events. Hal Sutton was there, and he was basically, for all intents and purposes, a pro. Corey Pavin, Ron Comans, Jody Mudd, you know, these players all existed. G.S. Siegel, who at the time was probably world number one, two amateur, Jim Holtgreave, you know, you were against formidable amateurs and youngsters who were coming through the game, and it was fabulous. I mean, what a place to, you know, the only time it's been held. I know it's back there in 2025 because I'm hopefully going to be going, and what a thrill to be able to be. And we had great leaders as well, because I mean, I remember you were saying about Joe Carr at the same event that Joe was apparently giving me a little bit of a rollicking for having a bit of a Barney out on the fairway. It was at the time he sort of, as he's finger waving, he said, and by the way, you're on the Walker Cup team.
Right, yeah. Which wasn't announced till the Sunday night.
Which wasn't announced till a few days later. So, you know, you were with good people. Michael Banalik had a lot to do with the team there as well. And he was a great leader too as well, because he played a lot of pro golf as an amateur too. So I think people that were in the background were good team leaders and people to fall back on. But it's still at that time, the amateur game was an amateur game. you know, three quarters of the team didn't stay and play the American Amateur the following week at Olympic because they had to go back to work. Where, well, why wouldn't you play the American Amateur? You know, what an opportunity. And so the ambition was different for a lot of the team.
That was just about the tipping point, actually.
Yeah, probably. Because
I did a story recently on the 75 Walker Cup, and the GB and I team then was basically working guys, amateurs, nearly all.
Yeah, and I had to take 3 days off to get time to go away.
Exactly.
You know, there was no team practice, you know, a month beforehand and getting together for a little, you know, practice
very
session.
Very different now.
Very different now. And, but then that's just the change of the game and the change of the people who are at the game. You know, every sport people get younger when they're coming through and being successful. So golf, and but you're absolutely right. I think that was the change. And the change was probably not necessarily from GB and I and you know, golfing unions and the RNA. It would have been for the like of somebody like Hal Sutton existing in America and traveling around coming to play, and you saw this figure, and then when you went and played him, you actually went, well, he's good, but he's not that, you know, he's not that much better than me.
I was just about to ask you, how did you compare with those guys, that string of guys you just mentioned?
There was a few different players out there, but actually, strangely, one of the best players is a guy who's completely unknown called Ron Comans, and he was a proper player. And I mean, so I'm not saying the rest of them weren't, but you know, he was in our mind the standout. And but they were all good. But I think it's not because you only ever read about these people and people. I don't remember, there's a golf magazine called Golf Illustrated that only came out every week, but the week after. So you never knew results about them, but you're always reading about Howe was winning the North South Amateur, and he was, you know, final of the American Amateur, final of this, final of that, and winning this in college golf and whatever it is. So this was this massive figurehead that was there, this blonde-haired kid who was apparently, you know, brilliant and better. And when you actually played him and played against him, you realize actually he's not. You could be equally as good if, of course, you had the facilities, which we didn't have, had the equipment that we didn't have, but just had the courses and things that we didn't have because winter golf. But you realize that you could beat him. And I think it's when you see them, and it's a bit like what's happened to the Ryder Cup team over the past sort of 30 years, is you only read about them in a magazine and then you saw them and then realized that they were just as nervous as you were, and they actually weren't any better players than you were. And that's why, you know, I think the day you realize that you can beat people who you think are better than is the day you go forward. And we were able to do that. And you know, the likes of Howe and stuff, when you saw them, were good players, but not unbeatable. And I think that was, as you know, that was the sort of change for all the game of golf was round about then.
Yeah. I mean, again, we're kind of moving past a lot of your, you know, your tournament play golf here, but I'm interested in the Ryder Cup. You contrast that with the Walker.
Well, the Ryder Cup is completely different. I mean, it is very, I mean, Jacko changed the Ryder Cup for us all, I think. You know, whenever there is a story when he was asked to do it, he said, "I'm first class, sir, I'm not doing it." And that's why Concord came about. We got gear, we got bags, we got treated properly. Well, again, you don't know this because you're not involved in it. It's only when you become involved in it that you hear the stories. But again, Tony was the most amazing captain. I have utmost respect for him because he had to be the most phenomenal man manager. Because
lots of egos,
and not enough presidential suites in the hotel.
Yeah.
You know, and you had players who had different games to make them successful. Nick Faldo out there who played golf like chess. You had Seve who just, you know, swished it all over the place, and, you know, you met him on the green and he hold the putt and suddenly he said, "Oh, that's a par." You know, you had Woozy who was firebrand and going, you know, who would make six birdies a day but make six bogeys. Yeah. And so that's why they ended up making a great team. Elazabel, who again came out and he was, again, a swashbuckler, the best long iron player probably in the game, certainly at the time. And he did a 3-iron as close as most people would hit a 9-iron. And then if he didn't, he'd up and down it from wherever he was anyway. So you showed people, and again, this is one of the things where you saw people from a different country who were better than you, who you then saw on the range and you want to be better than them. And, you know, I'd say, if you're not watching and you're not learning, you know, go and find a different profession. But, you know, when we went, it was all very different.
Is it quite as big a deal as it is now, even then? It was getting big,
again, I think it was something because we had nearly won in the year. Well, we'd won 85, 87, going into 89. But when the team changed to Europe, obviously everyone says that is the catalyst for the change. But the catalyst also was a change, was how good the Americans were and who was playing in it. And you know, Jack was still playing it, Weisskopf, Watson, you know, all these sort of guys were playing it. And it made our tour better and our players better. And it was absolutely the right thing to do to bring the tour against tour, not GB and I against, effectively the PGA Tour. So that changed it, and somebody made the right decision, which made us all better, because you then, more and more players were interacting together. And again, that's where I take it back to the whole thing of is you saw them, you read about them, but then you only saw them once in a while, like in a major. That's the only time you ever saw the better players. And then when you actually then played with them, you realized that they weren't that much better, but they did something different to you. And again, that's up to you to learn as a professional. It's what that thing was, be better for the better chippers, better putters, better thinkers, better under pressure. But you know, if you want to play a pro golf, you got to do it all, or you've got to learn how to do it all.
Yeah. Okay. Anecdote from that Ryder Cup. Give us a story. What comes to mind? The challenge you hear.
I think
take us behind the scenes a little bit.
Well, actually, you know, the scenes were very much Nick wanting to do his thing, Seve wanting to do his thing, Wizzy, who just wanted to stick his hand up for everyone. Seve, who, as you saw when he was captain in 97, wanted every shot for everyone, was the same. And was fabulous, because you felt as though these players who were better than, because they'd won majors, were trying to help you. You know, they were being chaperones to the, you know, they knew you were nervous because they must have been the day they picked it up. So they knew how you felt. But they wanted to make you better because the ambition was to win. And that's probably one of the things that makes them better than you. Why do they win majors and you don't? Why do you shoot a poor round on Sunday when they tend to do well and come up with something amazing? Well, that's what you learn. And they seem to want to show you that.
So that camaraderie stuff that we hear about is real.
I think that if you've played in a Ryder Cup before, if I'd have gone down the line, or say you were playing now and there was a rookie, I would hope that I would have the gumption and the wherewithal to stick my arm around his shoulder and go, what do you need? You know, because I know you can't breathe. You know, I know everything's going at 100 miles an hour. I know you're nervous, but tell us how we can make it better for you, which I think that's what happens today. And you can see that with a lot of the pairings and whatever. But we had, I'll go back to the fact that we had a great captain, somebody who understood the pressure of golf, who understood the pressure of playing in a Ryder Cup, who had come out the other end and was now captaining, who wanted to win and show you how to win. So everything was all orientated about doing the best thing then. And you do think that these captains were the ones that are the precursors to what the captains are doing now. They can't be doing anything different than these guys were doing.
No. Can you enjoy the experience?
So would you enjoy the experience of the Ryder Cup? I'm going to say, honestly, no, it's not until it's over that you enjoy it. It's not until you relive memories. And it's also when you meet your fellow, your opposition down the line. I mean, I played Kalkovecki three times. We played him twice in the foursomes and then again in the singles. So I'd seen him all week, you know, shuffling.
And he was the Open champion.
And he was the Open champion. Plus, he had a metal driver. You know, we hadn't seen him, but this is 89. Metal drivers, we'd only, again, read about them in a magazine. So he pulls the head cover off a metal driver in the first team. You know, he basically had a shotgun. You know, these things were going off, and they were longer. You mean they were 20 yards longer. So he had this bazooka driver that he was bombing down everywhere. And he was the Open champion. But he was still a fellow player. And in the end, you know, I managed to beat him on the Sunday. But it's not until afterwards when you're chatting, you know, and I'm not talking the next or that night at dinner or the next day when we play the Dunhill Cup the next week. So you're seeing a few of them again and you're actually taking a breath. You know, the week after was actually dead easy, you know, in a way, because there was nothing as nerve wracking as playing in the Ryder Cup. And you then ask the question, how do you feel in the first team? I don't know. Neither did I. You think, were you the Open champion? Oh, yeah. But it's that, because it's a different pressure situation, because when you're playing in a normal tournament, you're not under the gaze of everyone. all the time, where the Ryder Cup, you're under the gaze of everyone.
Well, that's the thing about the Ryder Cup. I mean, I've watched them, you know, since way back, even before 89, I've been watching, covering Ryder Cups, and it's amazing the difference.
Yeah, well, you're not used
even
to having...
between majors in the Ryder Cup, yeah, what it does to players.
Eight deep, you know, 55,000 people, eight deep, tee to green, wall to wall, only four matches. Yeah, 95% of obviously home gallery are all supporting you, cheering. You're not used to the noise. I mean, I remember playing tournaments even when I was, you know, doing well. You'd go to tournaments in certain countries where literally four people would be standing around a green. I remember going over to, I got invited to Greater Greensboro Classic one year when I went over, and I'd played a tournament in France, and literally there was four men and a dog watching the tournament. And they asked me to play in the Pro-Am. I thought, yeah, it'd be good to sort of get a nice sort of semi-competitive-ish practice round in. And went on the tee, and there was a grandstand with, you know, 30,000 people on it on the first tee for the Pro-Am. All going, you're the man, and shouting, whatever it is. And I was like, hang on. Even the Open in those days wasn't that big.
No.
You know, and you know, where the, you know, the today in the modern game, you when you speak to players, particularly those who are sort of dual... playing the dual tours, PGA Tour and US Tour, that the tournament that they want to play in and they want to succeed in and they want to be in and they want to perform in is like the Phoenix Open. And you're thinking, why is that? And of course, when you go to it, and it's because 220,000 people turn up today. You know, it's a zoo. The 16th is
most of them are drunk, though, let's be
honest. Well, but the 16th is the most raucous hole, whatever it is. And when I first went, I was horrified with this, you know, all this noise and people shouting, whatever it is. And then the second time I went, it was, yeah, actually, game needs to modernize into a version of this. And now we see it happening more and more often. But this was the tournament that the players themselves wanted to go and play in, because the whole thing was, if you can survive the Phoenix Open, you could play the rest of the tour, because nothing's as new, because there's three times the gallery, four times the gallery at just this one event than there were at majors, that there were at this. So this was the whole thing, go and play in the Phoenix Open. If you do well, it's great, because it's unbelievable.
In the midst of all this, Ronan, you've rattled off all the famous names that you played with and against. I'm thinking that top in the order of merit in 89, was it 89?
Yeah, 89, yeah.
Has to be the biggest achievement of your career.
But it was accumulation of a whole load of things. You know, my first win was on the European Tour was in May of that year. A few weeks later, Faldo and I had a shootout in the, at Woburn in the British Masters. We both shot the tournament record. He beat me by two. I think he shot like 17 under, I shot 15 under. A few weeks later, Elazabel beats me in a playoff for the longest ever playoff in the European Tour for the Dutch Open. And the very following week, I shoot 129 the weekend and win the Scandinavian. So things were progressing. So I was on the Ryder Cup team from May. They always wanted to fit me out for clothing and have me, and I wouldn't have any of it, you know, until the day I was picked, I wasn't having any of it, and the stuff still didn't fit me.
But you were a chubby wee soul.
I was, but those days. I was fitting, because we were playing a lot of golf and traveling, so you couldn't, you know. Certainly you wouldn't be as fit as you were, because basically the facilities weren't here. Yeah. But when you win an Order of Merit, it's not just something you win one tournament, you win the Order of Merit. It's accumulation of stuff. I mean, and again, this is something that you don't learn until afterwards in your career, that people tell you, they look up, or you're at a dinner and somebody mentions it. Like, I played something like 26 tournaments that year. I had 19 top 10 finishes, you know, and won three times and was beaten in a playoff and finished runner-up, you know, a couple other times. Yeah. And so that was, winning the Order of Merit was just a progression from doing that. Yeah. It wasn't one thing. And, okay, I won. But, you know, I have a thing as well in my career where I'm so proud of the fact I've won at Royal County Down, I've won at Valderrama, I won at Royal Melbourne, I won at Kingston Heath. You know, quarter of the tournaments that I've won around the world have been on the world's most outstanding golf courses. Yeah. And to me, that's like a bit of a...
You think Valderrama's outstanding?
You've got to see where it is in the world of golf and what it was and still is at the time. I mean, today...
I'm giving you the other three, by the way.
Well, Valderrama's relentless. You know, if you want to see how your golf game is, go and play Valderrama, play and practice at Valderrama. And again, today, if there was some young kid who wanted to be a pro, that would be one of the courses that I'd send him out to and say, go and play there for a couple of months and see how your game is. And because if you can play there, you can play anywhere. But I'm so proud of the fact in the background that I won at World's Outstanding Golf Courses. And so somewhere along the line, all the practice was worth it. You know, doing all the work was actually worth
Before
it.
I know you, this is for Golf Australia magazine production, this podcast. So we'll talk about Australia, which you've got a good history. But I'm interested in, you've obviously dabbled in the PGA Tour. Yeah. You never really went full time though.
No.
Why not?
First of all, you got what really happened happened is that nobody was exempt. So you had to always ask for an invite into anything. And so unless you were a major, filed a
set. So the order of merit didn't necessarily gain you anything.
It did. Well, it did a little bit. But even then, there wasn't enough invites. So pre a major, when Seve filed Olai, Woozy, Elizabeth, all wanted to go and play in the thing and wanted to play a few weeks beforehand, you were the next it. Along with the two or three Japanese, the three or four Australian, and anyone else from around the world who was a known player. So you weren't in the realms of the top flight again in the tournament. So even winning the Order of Merit, I struggled to get into tournaments pre a major. I could get into everything post a major, which I did, which then helped my TV career down the line, that you end up in all these obscure tournaments. But trying to get an invite into the stuff beforehand was a real hassle, and you had to do your schedule around. So, but in those days as well, the money on the PGA Tour and any major didn't count in the Order of Merit. And so the whole big thing was making the Ryder Cup team and being in the Order of Merit. So you always felt in a way obliged to play in Europe because those were the only points you could get to count in the Order of Merit. And so you couldn't guarantee up until weeks beforehand that you were in a tournament in the States, Houston, say Greater Greensboro, Atlantic Classic. So you were trying to do a schedule. You were trying to play your way into a major, but you weren't sure because you wanted to play in the 2 weeks basically in America. I always wanted the major to be my third tournament. And so we're, lots of them today, take 2 weeks off before a major. Well, I wanted to play my way in. And I think that is actually the way to do it. After going to doing a TV career, you can see that players are easing their way in and playing into a major and then they tend to do better. So you couldn't do a schedule. You were nearly sometimes not forced, but only because of the scheduling, and you couldn't get into the States. You ended up playing in a European tour event before then jumping over to the States, but you were then arriving to a golf course like US Open, USPGA. It was completely alien setup to what you'd been used to. You had no golf courses were set up like this at all in Europe. And so it was really hard to try and get a schedule that suited you in the early days. So you ended up turning stuff down, not playing, not entering, not doing this, because you had other thoughts about doing it that then suddenly it just went wrong. And then you would, and I know it sounds crazy, but you suddenly be looking at a gap where you thought you were going to play in America for 3 weeks and then you weren't, and then your stuff. And then suddenly there was you can play in Japan and then go to Atlanta. Do you want to go to Japan? And so you went.
The world rankings would have made things an awful lot easier, or did make things an awful lot easier in terms of the level of player you're talking about.
But there was still squiff towards America.
Yeah.
And so you could win a tournament in Europe and not get the same points as somebody finishing 25th in the States. But the problem was, because nobody was exempt, you couldn't get into the stuff. They didn't care if you won an Order of Merit or not, because you weren't a major winner and all these other guys were major winners. So that's who they wanted. And so it was a real fight to try and get a schedule. And then there was just a window. So it would have been 1991, 92, 93-ish. You could get into random tournaments, but never ended up making helping your schedule, because they said it was all post a major. And then, so to just go back a little bit, the reason why all this was happening is something you're asking about Australia. The reason this all happened was because I went to Australia. Yeah. I wasn't getting anywhere. Lots of good finishes, lots of top tens, lots of leaderboards, but never winning. And it wasn't until I went to Australia and you saw what, in a way, proper golf was. Even the smallest tournaments, they play around epic golf courses. And all the players were, in effect, better than you, because they played in these great courses, great facilities. They played in the Asian Tour, they traveled, but you never saw them again. These were the guys you read about in the magazine. Yeah. Greg Norman was about the only one traveling with Baker Finch. They sent me needs, come over, Peter Fowers, Peter Seniors, Roger Jay. There was a handful of guys came over in the early 80s, but none of the, should we say, the next ranked players. Well, the next ranked players were in a way nearly better, but just didn't travel because in those days, you know, well, Australia was a million miles away.
You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker. At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf lowest price guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
Why were you such a good fit in Australia? I mean, you've won multiple times there and in New Zealand. I mean, what were the best part, the strengths of your game were obviously fitting into the particular questions being asked.
Something really simple, and I still say it today, you know, because you can play all year, where we'd finish in the end of September, start of October, and then there was no golf unless you took yourself off to Asia in end of February. There was no golf, there was no practice facilities, nowhere to chip and putt, you know, waterproofs and off a mat and a range, you know, that's what it was for 4 months. When you were then trying to beat people who had been playing, their season was November, December, January, February, who are playing fabulous weather, fabulous courses, fabulously difficult courses, but with great facilities, all winter, where you never had a shot. And certainly no facility did a shot, couldn't chip and putt bunkers, you know, whatever. The most important bit of the game, where suddenly I was in an arena where it was, you're half playing well, half being on the leaderboard, but you had this facility like in the country, the golf courses. Head balls every day to practice all day, every hotel had a gym. You know, so you went to the gym because other players were suddenly going to the gym. You were playing 7 days a week, you're hitting balls, you're practicing, you're playing 36, so, you know, you're doing all in great weather all the time and great, epically difficult courses. And so it was just the next notch in the thing that somebody, you know, lifted you up into level 7 or 8 that let you go on and do some of them. You came back to Europe. It was actually easier because the courses weren't as difficult.
You become a bit of a connoisseur of courses, I know, as you've gotten older, especially Lynx Golf. Lynx Golf's got a lot in common with the
The courses were designed by people who came from Lynx courses, you know, great Scottish designers. And the land, you know, anyone who's had the privilege and pleasure of playing down Australia knows the whole sort of Melbourne sand. And so every golf course is basically just a sort of what you'd love a Lynx to look like, just with better weather. Yeah. And they're really difficult. And I think that was one of the things, is that the courses, even the courses, as I said earlier, for the minor tournaments were great. And the bigger tournaments, the Australian Open, Australian PGA and the likes, were even played on our legendary courses.
Yeah. But you've lapsed into politician mode here because you still haven't answered the question. What were the strengths of your games that fit particularly?
What would be the strengths of my game? I would say that I was average at everything.
Yeah, but that fit the questions being asked in Australia, particularly because, you know, you were incredibly successful there, you know.
Even beat Mike
Clayton in the final of the
Australian
match play.
Kingston Heath, I beat him on the last screen.
He'll listen to this, so that's
all right. Mike has gone on to do great things as well on the golf course. I see he was obviously watching more than I was. Yeah. Do you feel comfortable on golf courses? Do you feel comfortable in places? That's it. You know, I have a thing where, like the Italian Open, I played, I don't know, 16, 17, I never missed a cut. I had like 9 top 10 finishes, one at once, beaten in the playoff. So I went to Italy feeling good. Well, my first few weeks in Australia, I think I missed the cut my first tournament. The second tournament got abandoned because of the weather or something, and you're sitting there in a hotel room thinking I'm scheduled to be here for 4 months and I'm really, you know, I'm lonely and I'm a million miles away from home, and I nearly sort of went home, and it wasn't the pro said, you know, oh, you'll love it, look, you know, stay, just man. And then of course you then have a good tournament, then feel good, then put yourself, and then you win, and then suddenly you're off and running. And so
what were the strengths of your game?
Well, no, but I was just saying, you're saying, so A, I was average at everything, but B, I felt comfortable in the environment. And of course, you do feel comfortable in the environment that you're winning in. And that makes you better. And plus, I was playing with people who were good. And so I was practicing with people who were good and playing on tough golf courses that you needed to play well on and perform on. So you make, in a way, you make yourself better because it's a different skill set. It's different for you because, you know, most of the course, you aren't spinning it back. You know, you know the greens at Royal Melbourne and Roxall are the same, and they're fast. So, you know, we weren't used to this. We only played, you know, the only fast greens known to man were Augusta. And so these were epically quick greens, but in really great conditions and really tough conditions. And it was a fight or flight type thing. If you didn't play well, you were off on your backside. And you made yourself play well because you were playing with better players. Yeah,
I thought you would come to the conclusion that I mean, this is an incredible statistic, whether this is true or not.
Oh, you're going to, another one that I don't know.
Yeah, 62 top tens before you won. That's, it's an extraordinary level of consistency.
But
you'd start to wonder what you were doing wrong as well.
But that's why I took myself off to Australia, because something had to give. And, there was problems going to South Africa in those days with anti-apartheid. It was really difficult. Lots of countries are getting very twitchy about you having a South African stamp on your passport. So, and again, all these guys that came over at that stage, I was living in Ascot. Most of these Australians all lived in that area. So they were always in their weeks off. You had somebody good to play and practice with. And of course, it rubs off as in, well, why don't you come and play? And of course, November, December, January, February. Whoa, you couldn't ask better. It was also the time when the European Tour was branching out to, should we say, overseas tournaments. Dubai Desert Classic started, a Johnny Walker Classic. So you could suddenly see this, do you want to arrive in Dubai and then Asia, having not played for 4 months and being white as a ghost and hitting balls and coming out to some stinking hot country where you could play here and then basically on your way home just playing these. And if you see what I did, so I went down playing half decent. I came back on my way, one down there, and then I came back to Europe, and then, of course, you're straight into events, because I've been playing for 4 months.
Yeah, well, I think 4 months of playing golf in Australia would make anybody better.
And suddenly you find yourself on the leaderboard, thinking of it as no different than what you've just done. And everyone's coming out, and you can see them white as a ghost trying to find a golf game on the practice ground when it was 35 degrees and 99% humidity. Yeah. And so you were able to succeed in doing it. So it was literally just a... Again, I go back to this whole progression, making decisions. They're not always right, decisions that you make, but that was, should we say, a really good one.
This is a question, I've asked this question before of other people, but when you look back at your career now, how would you rate it against par, given your talent level? And are you disappointed by some aspects of it? Do you think you did better in other ways? I mean,
I'm not disappointed that I won. And I won in lots of different countries, but I never won in the UK. That's disappointing. I wish I've only done well. And I mean, people said, what's your best finish in the major? I mean, I finished ninth in St. Andrews 1984 as a 20-year-old, but I was never on the leaderboard. You know, it just happened to have a, good this last weekend and suddenly finished ninth. Yeah. But I was never playing in the last group. I did lead a major with nine to play, 94 at Turnberry. I wish I had done better in majors, being performed.
One top 10, that is definitely over par for you.
Well, the other one was Turnberry, where I finished double bogey, par, birdie, double bogey or something. And that's when I finished 11th. But I did mark, Nick Price won, and I did mark his scorecard on Sunday. So if anyone ever sees the scorecards at Turnberry, you'll see my signature on his card, unfortunately.
I didn't realize you were playing with him.
Yeah, on the Sunday. Love to have won in the UK. Love to have converted. There were certain tournaments I did well. I mean, I had two or three goals of winning the Scandinavian Open until I did win it. And I probably could have won it three or four times, could have won the Italian Open three or four times as well. Would have loved to have done better in majors, and probably should have done more about playing in America. Because regardless, it's still the ultimate place to sort of go and play.
It wasn't at the time.
And again, I go back to the fact people don't realize that nobody was exempt, and so you were absolutely fighting to be able to get in.
The group of, and you would fit in this group: Howard Clark, Mark James, Sam Torrance, Ken Brown. That kind of
never
hardly ever got to play in majors.
Ever. My first major out of an open championship was the Masters the year after I won the Ordre de Mer. and people expect you to do well. Well, I'd never seen the place before.
Well, here's how bad it was just before you came along. In 1980, I've probably said this before, when Seve won the Masters in 1980, he was playing in that Masters because he finished in the top one at the Open the year before.
Yes.
If he'd been second at Lytham, he wouldn't have been playing.
Well, that was necessarily. That was the same thing with winning the Order of Merit. Everyone thinks that you're an exempt. Well, you weren't. It was an invite. And still is. There's no exemption for winning the Order of Merit. It is an invite. And the same with all the others. I mean, even I remember at the end of that year, I was thinking of going to the Q School in America at the end of 89. And we played a tournament in Japan and all the American officials were there. And I'd got the entry form that had been sent to me, but I'm sitting on the plane reading this thing. And I had to go to the first stage, the qualifying school.
Yeah, it wasn't straight in the final.
It wasn't straight in the final. And I met with them, and lucky enough, the official got it. And they did change it, and I did end up getting invited to the final. But literally, on their criteria, I had to go to the first stage of the qualifying school.
And how did you do in the...
I missed by a shot or two and did get in. But they got me on in those times it was the fries.com tour or something like that. And I could have got a load of stuff. I could have played the whole circuit, but obviously I was playing in Europe. And because of it, I got invited to two or three American tournaments and stuff.
It's kind of sliding door moment. That. I mean, Sam Torrance on this podcast, he lost a playoff in the Southern Open, I think it was. And Ken his Brown, life would have changed.
And
completely.
Ken Brown did as well, I think.
Ken Brown won.
The one, whatever it is. But even then, in those days, I think it was only a 1 year exemption.
Yeah, probably.
And plus, you had to, you know, if you were going to do that, you'd have to have basically up sticks and gone and
but
lived.
Sam's
there.
Life, he said that, his life would have changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
If
but,
he won.
You know, but these are the, you know, the doors that open and shut. And sometimes you take them. Well, the thing about it is it leads to other stuff. You suddenly you do well there, but you don't win. But then obviously your game is better. People know your game are better. And suddenly you get invited into other things and your own status goes up a little bit. And so, you know, it's not all bad.
Well, that's true. You're the first ever winner of the Venezuela Open.
My very first win. Yeah, my very first one. Beat Andy North up the stretch for that one at Lagunita. God, that was a while ago. I was only 18. Seems so easy. These were the days. How about this? These are the days where you got paid in cash.
And so,
you had to queue up after the tournament and basically sit in a room and they check your passport, they check this, and then they'd check where you finish and basically tick off the thing. And then you had to go in a room and the guy literally watched you, all this cash, and it wasn't quite a brand name, but you know, you get this plastic thing. And I won $10,000. And suddenly I've got this $10,000 in cash I'm trying to fly home with and whatever it is and thought I was going to get arrested and all that stuff. But those, I remember, I think even up until, God, in the 90s when you played in tournaments in Hong Kong and stuff, you got paid in cash. Well, obviously.
Earning $10,000 in Venezuela, I can think of another way it could have been done.
But the other thing was it was in dollars and that was one of the nice things, but... You know, these were experiences again as well, because in those days, the South American tour was a 10, 11, 12 tournament circuit, again, over the winter. That was, at the time, a viable circuit, because there was lots of players who were coming to play in Europe at that time who had, spent the winter playing the South American tour, Chile, Argentina, Venezuela, whatever it is. And this was suddenly, the prize money was decent against other countries. Yes. And again, no disrespect, South Africa became unviable for outside reasons. And Australia seemed, again, a million miles away. So suddenly South America was a circuit that you suddenly thought of because you had a schedule. And I hated the break over the winter. That I always thought that was terrible for pros that we didn't have. And again, didn't happen until the late 80s that the European Tour progressed to going overseas. But then you see it, there's now, you wish you had it 40 odd years ago.
Absolutely. As things wound down, playing wise, you got into commentary.
I didn't want to.
I know you were.
I was injured and not playing. But it just happened. The World Golf Championships were starting. I was injured. They needed somebody who knew the players, knew the courses, and had been there. To come and chat about it, and it was all sort of new and fledgling out there. And
this
it was
Sky Sports.
This was Sky Sport. Well, even Eurosport before Sky Sport or something or thing. But I remember I worked with David Livingstone, who just retired a few years ago. But Andrew Castle, Yeah. And at the time, more famous for tennis. Yeah. And Andrew was sort of retired. And I think basically somebody has sort of said, you play a game with a ball, don't you? Right, you do the golf. And basically just translate tennis into golf. And I remember going into the studio one of my first times and sitting there going, basically, what do I do? He said, I'll ask you questions, you give the answers, but don't tell us what you think, because that's what you hear. When you're a guest, you're called a color artist. So you're in there trying to give color to the pictures that you're seeing. I mean, otherwise you could watch golf in silence and actually see what you need to see.
Sometimes that would be better, to be honest.
Sometimes today, yeah, I agree with you there. So he said, tell us what it's like to be in the middle of the fairway with a 5-iron off a bit of a downhill lie over water from 190 yards. You know, what's it like? Because that's what you're here for. And so Andrew was very good because, I mean, he was learning as well. So he was asking me stuff and I was telling him stuff. So you could have, as we are having, a golf conversation.
Teeing you up, basically.
Well, I think because people are fascinated about golf. You know, they think that I do something miraculous that they can't do. Which isn't true. They think I've got golf clubs that they don't have. You know, you're a pro, you get special clubs. Well, no. I practice with them. I use them. I know that, yes, I've got, maybe today there's a lot more information. But there's nothing I don't have that I have that you can't get. And it's just a matter of knowing how they're used. And so, you know, the questions were all about, you know, shafts, chipping over bunkers, chipping over water, backspin, you know, all this sort of stuff. Because people hit the ball and you know, you hit the ball with a Blatt, a Titleist with a wooden driver. Well, it didn't go very far, but it did at the time. It went perfectly far. Yeah. And it wasn't until we moved to metal drivers, the 89, that Cal, you know, hold the head cover of a metal driver. Well, of course it's going to go further because it's metal. Golf balls changed. The length of the shaft changed. It went from steel to graphite. The weight of the shaft changed. These were all things progressed in the game of golf that were happening in front of you that you were able to tell people because you were still playing, you're still relatively active, but your job description had changed from being a player and doing it to then telling them how they can do it too.
Yeah. That was how you saw your role, was it? Just to...
Yeah. And the fact that they quite like the fact that if they went up to some player, you tell them to bugger off, and if I went up to them, they'd have a chat with you.
Yeah.
So you're able to access other players. You're able to waltz onto the putting green and chat to them like you fell abroad. So it was quite nice in that way. You still felt you were part of the game. And again, you asked me the first question, what was golf? Well, golf was being involved in the game and being in this position to be able to go in. And it's still the same today. I'm the ambassador for the Renaissance Club. We hold the Scottish Open. The young fellas all turn up. For a week and waltz around here, you still feel part of it. You're in the background. They know you. You know them. You want to help them. You want to tell them. But sometimes I do feel as though I want to go up to go, what are you doing? You know, you're a better player than this, or you should be doing this, because nothing in that aspect has changed. They hit it further and the clubs are better and easier to hit and whatever it is. But have they got skill? Have they got talent? Lots of them have, few of them haven't.
Well, my thing on this, as we're getting into it a little bit, the equipment, distance, all the rest of it.
But there's lots in the background. You know, you can't just say equipment and distance because, you know, they're training far more. There's far more information. The coaching is better. Golf balls on the range are better. Length of shafts are better. Weight of shafts are better. The head, they're built better. You know, it's titanium. The weighting is better. The golf balls are better. You know, it's not one thing. It is a multitude of things put together to make you better.
Yeah, but my frustration is not... It's starting to sound like a bit of an old fuddy-duddy, I know, but I reckon the game that you played, your time of playing, was far more interesting to watch.
You had to work the ball.
And the ball went sideways.
Yeah, you had to work the ball.
The players, modern players, some of them take it as a criticism when you say, well, you shape the ball anymore because, well, the equipment doesn't really let them. They don't have to do it, so they don't do it. But it's not to say they couldn't. Of course they could. If the game had evolved that way.
But
the game's, it's not as good to watch at the top. Isn't.
There'd be a few things that I'd maybe like to do, but it was the stuff you had at the time. You had to deal with it. But, you know, were there things slightly easier? The fact you could change your golf ball. You know, people don't know the advantage or don't remember the advantage of being able to play a more solid ball into the breeze and then one that spun more down the breeze.
But and even basically playing with Top Flights that's
Now. I remember, I think it was a thing called a Max Fly Hot Dot or something like this. I mean, it was like a rock. You hit the board and it would clink, you know, whatever it is, where you could sit with it, where you could sit with a Blatter Titleist, nearly peel the cover off it. Yeah. And golf balls only lasted, I mean, those soft balls only lasted, well, basically the first time you hit a sand wedge and then it just frayed. Yeah. It basically bubbled. I mean, people forget, you know, that we used to change balls every, well, I did every sort of minimum six holes, and that's only because you didn't get any. You got six balls at the start of the week. If you made the cut, you got another six balls.
Yeah. So are you like me? Are you frustrated the way it's gone at the top level?
In certain things, yes-ish, because it's not that it's too easy for them, but, you know, if you're really good, you need a challenge. And to me, the golf courses aren't challenging enough. There's not enough.
Well, they're hitting wedged every hole.
There's not enough there to challenge them, basically, whether it be hazards, whether it be this, whether it be narrow and fairways. But, you know, there's a lot of golf courses, I would say, tournament courses or sleep at the wheel. You know, it's not, you know, equipment just hasn't happened overnight. It's been happening forever. And everyone's been sitting back in their laurels thinking, oh, our course is good enough and whatever it is. Well, look at the length of golf courses 50, 60 years ago and look at what you are today. People say, oh, we've not changed. You know, we've not done this. Well, actually, yeah. And here's the seven different tees. And, you know, your fourth hole used to be 330 yards. Now it's 430 yards.
I mean, I get frustrated. I mean, we're sitting very close to one of the highlights of the year for me. The year's just finishing was Rory's second shot to the 18th green here at Renaissance. I mean, that was like a step back in time for me, and it made me think that part of the problem is that they don't shape shots.
I'm going to stop you for a second. The more impressive shot was his tee shot into 17.
Well, possibly, yes.
And when you see it as well, I mean, he's hit a big hold-up cut into a very severe right-to-left breeze into a green that's all running right-to-left as well, and that was probably a more impressive shot, although...
But that was because he was hitting long irons, and long irons are easier to shape because there's less loft.
Absolutely,
and blah, blah, blah. But they very rarely hit long irons anymore. Yeah.
Well,
that's part of why we don't see the shape.
But also he hit, you know, punch shots. If you see during the day, because it was breezy, he said punch shots. But then that's because, you know, playing here is a challenge. The wind's a challenge. So should we give them more challenges?
Just a bigger variety.
I think that there's lots. I mean, this is too big a conversation because it's not one thing. But... you know, the courses are too standard, they're too easy. You know, there's lots of things you can do with golf courses to set them up for tournaments that actually will be enjoyable for the normal amateur and player. You don't have to put all the bunkers in a spot where people next week are going to be hitting it into it, things. But you also still can't have a golf course where if a player hits a bunker, he stands in there with a 5-iron and knocks it on the green. It's got to be a hazard. Can't be as, and you see that with our great links courses. You know, the whole thing with, say, a Muirfield is it's not hugely long, but you knock it in the bunker, it's a penalty. Same with St Andrews. You knock it in the bunker, it's a penalty. But apparently they have no problem with that when they play the Open Championship. They think, oh, St Andrews, bunker's the team. It's Muirfield, the bunker's the team. Well, let's have that every second week or every week on tour. If we drive it in the fairway bunker, because these guys are so good, they should be missing them. And these guys have got all the yardages and they've got caddies telling them and they've got entourage telling them. So, of course, that's the hazard that you're supposed to miss. So why have you hit it in there? And if you hit it in there, you need to be penalised.
But I know there's a ball... something coming very soon.
Well, it's whether it be the problem is whether it's right.
People will know what it is by the time they hear this podcast. But it's at the top level.
I don't think reining the golf ball back is the right thing. Nobody comes here to the Scottish Open to see somebody hit it shorter. Now they may complete. They may
all they do is move up a tee.
The other thing is, I mean, you know, I know lots of countries who do the things right, where if you play off a certain handicap, you play off this tee and you move back. People need to play off the appropriate yardage for the handicap and their ability and not feel shy about it. It's a game to enjoy, you know, not to be suffering.
I saw something on social media, Paul Eales, who you'll know, plays at Lytham a lot. And he come as a guest to play at Lytham, he says to them, do you want to which tees do you want to play? And they want to play the tees that they want to play the game that the pros play.
Oh, yeah.
So he says, right, well, we'll play off the ladies' tees then.
Yeah, because you'll be hitting the same club.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
and the same thing here, I mean, they all hit it, you know, they all hit it miles. I mean, when you're on the practice ground, you can't tell one who shot 78 and the other guy shot 65. They all go bang, 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 bang. So there is obviously some sort of skill in the game. But you know, length, you know, how do you combat length? If you rein the golf ball in and say that it's got, we're going to make it 15 or 10% shorter, long hitters are still the long hitter.
Well, they should get an advantage, but the advantage now, there's two ways of looking at it. The average driver now on the tour is way closer to the best driver than he should be. Because the driver in your day with the Persimmon was the hardest club in the bag. Now it's the easiest club for guys at that level.
Well, yes, I agree. And, you know, there's no reason to...
I mean, Rory's the best driver, say.
You could easily
get the benefit of it.
You should get. You could easily do it because, you know, there are several companies making mini drivers, which are basically three-quarter size. And lots of players are using them. So you're going to bring in potentially a club that's like, oh, this has gone from huge to dinky, yeah. Because they're already playing with stuff that you can easily ease into the game. But you know, there's lots of things in the background. You should see, I mean, we have a gym here in the clubhouse. You should see them in the gym, the European Tour unit. You should see their exercise that they're doing. Do I think they practice properly? No, but they practice a different game. You know, it's very much a strength game. Short game isn't as important as it absolutely used to be.
I mean, there was a thing, again, social media. Brad Hughes, Australian.
Teacher,
he went on social media and said that one year he was the 21st longest driver on the PGA Tour, the Pro V1 came out, he gained a yard and he was outside the top 100 a year later.
Yeah.
And he made the point that, oh, all these guys must have got really athletic in that 12 months.
No.
You know, it was nothing to do with athleticism.
And the same thing with the drivers as well is that unless you have the right type of swing as well, a lot of these drivers don't work for me unless you can hit them on the up and hit them in the air.
Well, Woozy didn't get any benefit from it.
And I did neither because I leaned on it because I learned all my, you know, I played all my sort of amateur golf and links golf. So you're trapping it instead of hitting it in the air. Where if you played in America, of course, it was exactly the opposite. So it just happens to be that not all equipment benefits players, and some equipment makes lesser players better quicker. But then, you know, how do you progress with golf clubs? Because I mean, back in the day, we had, you know, a 5-wood. You know, 7-woods and 9-woods didn't exist. Well, a 5-wood then became the sort of precursor to a rescue club. And then all of a sudden, driving irons became, and players didn't want a rescue because they wanted a driving iron. And then now it's exactly the opposite, where there's now an awful lot more pros now putting 7-woods in their bag and a few of them 9-woods in their bag. Because they want to hit the ball in the air to the, well, get out of the rough further than the conditions you want to do. So somebody has made a club through no fault of their own. That's just making the game easier for you. And that's game progression. I mean, if you go into any golf museum, particularly even the R&A, you see the progression of golf clubs. And you think, first of all, you look back at some of the clubs that they used to hit and you think, how did you hit that? Yeah. I don't care if it was the club for the time, but how the hell did you hit that? And then you look at the clubs and you think, actually, that design was designed 100 years ago.
Well, Peter Alice used to argue that the most skillful golfers of all time were the guys who played between the wars with the equipment that you're kind of describing. It's remarkable what scores
they... And you see them today where they bring it out. I see it at some of the tournaments on social media where they'll have a driver or a wedge or something for a player to hit out on the thing and they can't hit them.
That's right.
But you look at them and think, how did you hit them?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And you do see, I've been privileged to, you know, played at Augusta and Eastlake, where Bobby Jones, you know, big connection. And there's a set of his clubs, you know, in the thing, and they're all wooden shafted. And you hear the story about it was one basically log from a tree that he had all cut into shafts. And then, you know, they basically sanded them down, but they made them stiffer. To start with, because once you practice with them, it made them more whippy. And then halfway through the season, you had to change them. Mm-hmm. An individual shaft, well, stuff broke, or frayed, or chipped, or whatever it is. So you had to change the shaft. So you had to do it, and you had to do it really slowly. And the sort of thing for today, you hit a bad shot, you change the shaft, and you go out and you play again. Oh, and by the way, it goes further.
Yes.
Well, the other thing as well is that what's affecting the game, of course, is the loft of clubs today, where, you know, people are basically thinking, oh, I'm a club longer. Well, it's not that. That's just a 6-iron with 7-iron with 7 on it.
Yeah. We're going to finish off. We're nearly there. You'll be placed in order.
No, I can talk. Don't worry.
Oh, I know you can. I ask this question a lot now. I feel like I ask it in every podcast, but it's almost have to. The LIV Golf, professional golf state of affairs, you look at it from a distance now. What do you think when you watch it?
What's going on?
Well, so again, we don't have enough time, you know, we don't have 3 or 4 days conversation over this to have, but my thought is today, you know, a bit of a shock when it all happened, because it was sort of wasn't expecting. You thought that if an entity came in with a stonking amount of money, that somebody should have been taking, you know, putting their hand out and taking it, because how do we get sponsorship? How do we play a tournament around the world unless you've got people giving us money? It was sad. I think the sort of breakup, the initial breakup, obviously there is a motivation at the moment to be a bit more congenial, we would say. I think, one, it was bad that it caused so much animosity in the split, but also you got to think about it is that it is professional golf. I play golf for a living. There's somebody willing to stick up a huge amount of money into the game. We should be happy that there are these entities, and you now hear that the PGA Tour are looking for strategic investors to come into the tour, their pension fund, the players, you see the prize funds being boosted. You see the prize funds in Asia being boosted. You see the prize funds in Australia. You know, Australia was a fabulous tour, 12 tournaments over the winter, went down to 2 with no money, no players. I mean, the Australian Open at one stage used to be called the fifth major. Now it doesn't even get a field. I think they even went through the entire buddy exemption list to get a field. And now you have an entity who is willing to throw money at the world of golf, and that it's making others look, and because that's what we do. We play golf for a living. So it's great in one way that this has been a catalyst, I think, for pushing more money into the world of golf. And it's amazing how much money the PGA Tour suddenly found. You got to ask yourself the question is where has it all been?
Bill Mickelson's point.
Well, yeah. Where has it all been? So it's obviously somewhere, but it's then helping other tours around the world boast of themselves as well. Because what we do need is, and what we are trying to push for, is making the game of golf accessible for everyone in the world. And so, you know, maybe, you know, and I said something earlier. You know, the South American Tour used to be a recognized, well-known tour, whereas now nothing, you know, nobody even thinks of South America. Should we be, is this money going to help the South American Tour come back to being a big, huge tour, 10, 12 tournaments for somebody else to play? And by the way, somebody else to win and somebody else to progress and somebody else that we'll be reading about in a year or two time, and suddenly else that he appears and winning tournaments and winning majors and doing well around the world. You see that at the moment with the Korean players, a lot of them are particularly on the ladies tour, but coming into the men's tour, these are now the players who are willing to travel because they had to travel outside their own country to play and succeed. And that, to me, is the really big benefit of having Saudi money coming into the game.
Would you have looked at it as a purely business thing, the moral aspect of it, which troubles a lot of people?
You know, my answer to this is that if I had had a conscience about where the money was coming from, I'd have never played in South Africa in the early days. I played 7 tournaments in Russia. We played as a European tour, seniors tour in Russia, in Asia, in certain countries, even in America, if you want to ask the question. But I remember that when the Dubai Desert Classic tournament was happening, I wish I had kept the letter, but basically written to by the European Tour to say, please support this tournament to promote the game of golf in a non-golfing country. And to me, that's what I do. I play golf in the country and whatever it is. So, do I have a conscience about it? No, because does all of sport have a conscience? And I remember, you know, again, you're asking the live question, is that these guys were getting chastised and then followed by, you know, some boxers having his world championship fight there and the Grand Prix on the following week. And you're thinking, hang on. And you can't have one hand saying that that's all right and the other hand saying it's not.
I do wonder slightly why golf got such a hard time because of the things that you just mentioned. I mean,
well, because they think that every player, I think, is like Tiger. And so you play the tour, you've earned enough money, you fly around in a private jet. So why do you need any more? Well, then why does, you know, well, why does any sportsman or any business need any more money than whatever they have? Well, it's what you play for and it's what you have, but it's what you then see down the line is you have players saying, well, I didn't want to ruin my legacy. That's why I didn't go. Well, you have other problems. Well, I wanted to secure my legacy, and that's why I did go. I play, you answer to the business decision, and the answer to me is yes, because I play golf for a living, it pays the bills. And when the Inland Revenue starts accepting goodwill, then I'll play in tournaments for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before on here, that the mistake, if you can call it that, that Jay Monahan made was making it a moral thing.
Yes.
And once
lots of them did.
You can change your mind in business, and people do it all the time. Yeah. Easy to do. But if you've gone down the moral route, your morals are what they are, and you can't change them.
Well,
he dug himself a hole, I thought.
Everyone gets their own way. And the thing about it is, I put it as simply as well, is that what golf clubs do people change? Why does somebody play, TaylorMade Callaway, Ping, Titleist? Well, it's a decision you got to make, because you feel that suits you in the best way.
So basically, you're saying you've got to separate that. I mean, everybody's appalled by some of the stuff that goes on in Saudi Arabia.
We could be appalled in some of the stuff that goes around anywhere. Are you benefiting? And I go back to what I was saying. You know, this change has benefited golf around the world, and so Asia, Australia. Hopefully, as South America comes in this world, more and more players are certainly interested in the game of golf. Is it being shown in different mediums? I mean, the thing about it is, we're so used to seeing it on a channel. You know, we are of the era where there was only three channels on TV. Now there's 1,003, if not more.
Yeah.
But we don't watch 99% of them. Doesn't mean they don't exist, not mean there's not a huge amount of people out there. And just because I don't watch golf or sport on my phone, I never have. I mean, I've never even sat on a plane and watched a movie because the screen's too small. And I don't listen to radio. Right. So why should I be offended by somebody who wants to watch golf on their phone in Asia and subscribe to a channel and watch the game of golf? Because he might be the next player that comes from wherever he is. And by the way, that's what we're here for, is growing the game of golf.
So you would have taken the Saudi money right at the beginning.
I think they probably wouldn't have got to the end of the question before I'd have said yes.
Yeah.
Because I'm a pro. I mean, countries need to get into the, if you want to get into the moral ground of it, the countries need to get into the moral ground. Of where they take the money from. And again, when they start chastising other sports, I'll start worrying about it.
Just to round that off then, what's your hope for how this is all going to end up?
I hope they all get together.
What would you like to see at the end of it?
I mean, I think that people have missed certainly the star players that we had on our tours that have, gone and have been missing. And I think that again, little things that happened, and one of them had to be Koepka winning the PGA Championship, changed the attitude, because it all happened after that. And that was because you could not pick a major champion on a Ryder Cup team.
Yeah.
And lucky for him in a way that it wasn't PGA Tour against European Tour. Mm-hmm. It was the PGA of America versus the European Tour.
There's no way the Tour would have picked.
And then there's no way. Well, they would have made. Well, they wouldn't have done right. You're probably right. But it did, and it changed the game. And somebody obviously saw the light who stood up and said, guys, look, I know this isn't difficult, but you need to talk. And you don't get anywhere if you don't talk. And by the way, it's so much money, no tour can walk away from it.
But I'm interested in what you think the end result is, or what would you like the end result to be? Like, is it going to be a global tour of 25 events or 20 events? How's it going to work?
Sorry, I still go back to the whole thing that if you can build tours in these other countries, you then never know. Because in the background, people don't know, there is a South American tour, but it's part of the sort of PGA Tour umbrella. There is a Canadian tour, again, part of the PGA umbrella. There is a reason why they're doing this university thing. We've just seen Ludvig Eidberg come in from that. We forget he was an amateur in the middle of June, never played in a major. Now he's a world star. Well, never did this. There's a reason why you're developing the game. And so and then there's a Chinese tour, there's an Asian tour, there's a Korean tour, there's even offshoots of this South African tour, but there's a South African mini tour. And so you're building the game up in the background. So why we have half of Europe, more than half of Europe, we don't play tournaments in, but we know there's golf courses in them. So how do you get the money for these things? Well, obviously these countries might not necessarily have the infrastructure or the companies involved to stick in 5 million to have a golf tournament. Well, if some entity does to help build the game and some of the countries, surely that's got to be a good thing. So I think that this helps us. I wouldn't necessarily want to see 25 tournaments where 20 of them are in America. Australia's got huge amount of we have tournaments, golf courses around here. You could have tournaments, and every week can be world class golf tournaments and golf courses. I mean, they've all held within an hour's driving distance. You've got courses that have held a dozen tournaments, and with a lot of open championships. So we've got it all going around here, and so why can't you have tournaments that are going on around? Everyone's got to start somewhere. Everyone's got to play somewhere. That's why mini tours exist. That's why secondary tours, third tours, into the thing, challenge tours exist into the main goal, and that's what you got to get. So the money for it all has got to come from somewhere.
How do you feel about the talking of money? It's such a bad look, this 15 million that Rory got for this social media thing.
It's very different.
I mean, for the ordinary guy in the street, that's a pretty odious.
It is a pretty, because, Rory, Tiger, and whatever.
It's not Rory's fault, obviously.
Well, they're always probably going to win it or be in the top three or four of that or whatever. And anyone who is active is going. But it is a promotion. You are trying to promote the game of golf and companies and tours and this and that.
Yeah, Rory doesn't need $15 million.
No. I'm not saying for any. It's only maybe because I don't understand it, and I'm not involved in it, and I don't see the benefit of it, where other people do, and I don't see the benefit of saying, hey, I'm sitting here having a cup of coffee and think that people are going to be interested in it. But it obviously is a different. I'm not sitting on my phone watching a golf tournament with an ad pop up, nor does it influence my life.
It's because you're an old fart.
But it doesn't mean that there isn't some kid sitting here looking at it and thinking that this is what his ambition wants to be, because this is happening in front of him on his phone. So it's just very different.
Yeah, I mean, I get why they're on social media. I just don't see why they should.
Why you need to be
getting this money so much for doing money.
But
nothing,
really. I won. So a question you asked earlier, I won the Order of Merit 89. I won the Volvo Masters to win the Order of Merit. And I won the tournament and won £65,000 when I won the tournament. I also got a £65,000 bonus for winning the tour for the Order of Merit.
Right. Such an arbitrary figure. Why was it?
No idea why it was. Yeah. But I think it was that they were matching the prize money, whatever it is. But it was for the top 10 of the Order of Merit got a bonus. And say, I happened to win the tournament to win the Order of Merit. And that was, so was that bad that one of the most prestigious tournaments on the tour was giving me a bonus that equaled the prize money, equaled the first prize? Was that obscene?
It's not quite as obnoxious as 15 million.
I know, but it was at the time. It was a huge. I mean, I won, I think, round about £400,000 for winning the Order of Merit. For £400,000, doesn't keep your card. Yeah. So was it an obnoxious amount of money at the time? Yeah, probably. Where most prize funds were 40, 50. I mean, I think when I won Italy, I won 45,000. And then I won Spain and won 65.
Where's it all gone?
Well, I got a 60. Life. I got a 65,000 bonus for nothing, for doing what I was doing anyway. And so was it an awful lot of money? Yeah, it was. Yeah. But, progression, tournaments, would you, people, you can ask all the time, would you like to be playing today? Yeah, hell yeah. Of course I would be. Would I hope I was a better player? Yeah, I would be, because the information is out there, the equipment is out there. Can you stand, as I do on the practice ground here for the Scottish, and look at players and think, actually, mate, give me a couple of weeks practice and I might take you on.
Well, that's another thing about the equipment. They get away with poorer technique.
Yeah, well, they do. But it's different. And I do think, I was lucky. I was probably also where I had ambition to go forward. I also knew the time to walk. And I think that's very important. There's lots of them don't know when to walk.
That's a good way to finish. What a great way to finish. Ronan, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, John.
Some terrific behind-the-scenes stories in that lot, and some valuable nuggets of wisdom too. Big thanks to both Ronan Rafferty and John Huggan for their time and effort in bringing us that interview. Well, for all the fascination with the game's globetrotting stars, For most golfers, the professional they know best is the PGA member at their home club. Like course superintendents and green staff, the club professional is a vastly underappreciated cog in the giant machine that is golf. On our next, we're going to get a peek into what makes not one successful club professional, but a three-generation dynasty of them.
I've been here in my current position for, you know, about 18 years, and then two sons, Fraser, who did his traineeship, and now I've got Baxter, who's in his just starting his third year with me as a trainee here at this golf club.
That's Evan Droop, head professional of the Yarrawonga and Border Country Club, and the story of dynasty. Next time on The Thing About Golf.